In this news roundup of the week, the Tory civil war to take out Boris Johnson goes up a gear, but he plans to fight to the end. Joe Biden's voting reform bill fails as predicted, and he suggests the next election will be stolen as a result. And Joe Biden also alarms Ukraine by suggesting that a minor invasion by Russia might be sort of okay. My name's Malin Baker. This is The Malin Baker Show. The Boris Johnson fight for survival kicked into even higher gear this week, with the cascading chain of consequences looking one minute as though it was unstoppable, the next that it may be put onto a short-term pause. What is in little doubt is that Johnson is determined to cling on to the bitter end, still convinced that if he can just ride this one out for a bit longer, he's still in with a shot of being the one to lead the Conservatives into the next election. That may be the case, but it's looking increasingly like he will have to fend off a party vote in order to do so. As I mentioned last week, the party establishment is in no particular hurry on this, but the momentum is coming from the newest intake of MPs, those who came in the 2019 swing against Labour because of Brexit. Those MPs, who are not old hands and believe that if something isn't done quickly, they'll never get the opportunity to become old hands, they are the ones who are actively plotting to get rid of a Prime Minister. The system is that individual MPs can submit a letter to the chairman of the so-called 1922 committee, Graham Brady, expressing an absence of confidence in the leader. When the number of letters reaches 54, then it triggers a confidence vote. A number of people are said to be waiting on the independent report on the various parties that took place at No. 10 Downing Street against the lockdown rules that were in place at the time. Originally, it was thought that that report would be relatively favourable to the Prime Minister, or at least neutral. But as more details have come out, it's starting to become apparent that that may not be the case. Just another excuse for all the newspapers to print those endless photos of Boris Johnson doing his idiotic-looking head-grabbing thing, surely likely to become the defining image by which he is remembered. The momentum against him was briefly paused when one of the plotters gave up the ghost and crossed the floor of the House to defect to the Labour Party. Indeed, some of the plotters are said to have been confident that they were going to cross that threshold for letters this week, but that defection brought everything to a halt. Defection is a step that's guaranteed to unite the party in condemnation, and in the immediate aftermath, some of the plotters reportedly withdrew letters that they'd already submitted. It's thought that Labour set the timing for the defection, and they're currently floating rumours of similar defections, and this is largely because it suits them down to the ground if this whole process could get drawn out for as long as possible to do the maximum damage. In the meantime, the Prime Minister was attacked on all fronts in the weekly Prime Minister's Questions. Now, I rarely listen to that these days. I did listen to at least the start of it this week. It was truly remarkable how someone can be asked straight questions and simply make no attempt whatsoever to answer any of them. It would have been hard for Boris Johnson to give answers to some of those questions, of course, because lying to Parliament is a sacking offence, and if he didn't lie, then he'd have to admit that he previously lied. So he just didn't answer. The Prime Minister claimed nobody told him it was a party. Everyone knew it was a party, except for him. He thought it was a work meeting. It is absurd, it is surreal, and yet there it is. And we even had one of the senior party figures, David Davis, making headlines of his own by boldly saying to his own party leader, "In God's name, just go." And a continuing circus of it all, with Johnson's changing and increasingly ridiculous denials, is pushing the whole thing into that too toxic to put up with box that I mentioned last week. One of Johnson's ministers was reported to say this: "The mood has turned dramatically. He's in real trouble. And it's not just for 2019ers panicking about their seats. It's quieter, older colleagues. Unless the report says something staggeringly good, we will have a challenge." Another MP was reported as saying this: "It's terminal. It's turned from red-hot anger to a cold, calculating sense of how do we do this and who are we supporting? It's a question of when, not whether." And that should really worry Boris Johnson, because it shows that MPs have already started to, as they say, to see beyond the sale. They're no longer wondering whether or not to support him. They're working out who should replace him. The other thing working against him is that he's losing support from all wings of the party. So if it was a policy issue, an ideology issue, then he would have a base, a group that was lined up behind his policy. But it isn't. It's a character issue. It's a competence issue. And his operation has been so shambolic, there will now be very few believing that their side will be better served if he stays in position for longer. Again, does this guarantee that he's gone? There are no guarantees. It's closer now than it was this time last week. The Tories' nightmare scenario, which is not at all unlikely, to be honest, is that the challenge is triggered and Boris Johnson survives. So he carries on, weakened but not defeated. And once a contest has taken place, another one can't be triggered for another year. So some MPs are arguing it would be better to wait, at least for the local elections in May, when you might reasonably expect the Tories to be punished quite harshly by the electorate for what's happened over the last few weeks. But if a report from civil servant Sue Gray comes out, which it will do very soon, probably next week, and it doesn't damn Johnson at all, then there will be some soul searching on the part of the plotters as to whether they need to wait for a clearer moment, knowing full well that Boris Johnson will give them such a moment in due course because he just can't help himself. If it's critical, the report, then the first domino will certainly be toppled. The question will then be just how many more of those dominoes will fall, and will it be enough? The sense of panic is evident in how the party whips have been accused of bullying and blackmailing MPs who are thought to be likely to submit letters of no confidence, to the extent where the Speaker of the House of Commons gave a statement saying this: "While the whipping system is long established, it is of course a contempt to obstruct members in their discharge of their duty, or to attempt to stop a member in their parliamentary conduct by threats." Boris Johnson was asked to respond to the allegations, and he gave the now typical weasel words reply. He had not seen or heard any evidence to support them. Just like he had seen no emails suggesting that the drinks party was a party. At this stage, it's all just contemptible rubbish, unfortunately. It's a shame. Didn't need to be this way, but he has proven himself arguably unfit by any normal standards of what we expect from our leaders. Now, if this does play out in the short term, who will be the next Prime Minister? The current Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, is said to have the slickest, most ready campaign operation, which is no guarantee in itself. Then there's the Foreign Secretary, Liz Truss, Health Secretary, Sajid Javid, Education Secretary, Nadim Zahawi. Others on the fringes will probably also throw their hats into the ring. None of them are such a charismatic figure with the public that they are likely to have many assets that aren't based on simply not being Boris Johnson. They will go into the next election with at least the advantage that their main opponent, unless there's a change there, of course, will be similarly described. Pretty much a charisma-free zone. Right now, all of that seems a long way off. Now, in the US, we were reminded why President Joe Biden rarely does press conferences, as he did a 2-hour marathon to mark his first year in office, and his team had to desperately scramble afterwards to correct, they would say, clarify what he said. And it mattered, because some of those comments would have major world consequences left uncorrected. We will come to all that in just a minute. But first, a couple of weeks ago, a paper was published asking the question whether the imperative to tackle climate change means that authoritarian forms of government, or simply authoritarian actions by otherwise democratic governments, should have gained added legitimacy. It's hardly the first time someone's raised the question, and at its heart, it's a pretty contentious one. It's probably going to be raised in the future, so let's stare it in the face and understand the arguments we can expect to hear and see what logic or evidence, if any, is suggested as supporting them. That's what I'll be looking at in the next deep dive video, going live on this channel, 7 p.m. UK time on Monday next week. Join me for that. Unexpected drama in US politics as the thing that had been predicted to happen for months happened exactly how it had been predicted. In other words, US Democrats sought to push their voting rights bill through the Senate by abolishing the filibuster. It had been clear for a very long time that such an attempt was doomed because there wasn't a majority for it. They tried it anyway, and it failed. Senator Joe Manchin explained why he had done what he said he would do all along when he said this. Eliminating the filibuster would be the easy way out. It wasn't meant to be easy. I cannot support such a perilous course for this nation when elected leaders are sent to Washington to unite our country, not to divide our country. And he added this, I was part of a very troubling conversation last evening. It was shared depending on which side you're on in this body today on this issue. You're either a racist or a hypocrite. Really, is that where we are? The unnecessary and genuinely dangerous part came earlier when President Joe Biden said that the legitimacy of the upcoming midterm elections could depend on passing his voting legislation. The increase in the prospect of being illegitimate is in direct proportion to us not being able to get these reforms passed, he said. So you now have both political parties embracing the tactic of calling elections that they lose illegitimate. In my eyes, that makes both of them unfit to hold office. This is something of a dilemma in a de facto two-party system. And that's barely improved by the scrabbling that took place afterwards where Biden's team tried to make it clear that no, he wasn't saying that the 2022 election would be illegitimate. Don't be silly. Jen Psaki said this. He was explaining that the results would be illegitimate if states do what the former president asked them to do after the 2020 election, toss out ballots and overturn results after the fact. That's not remotely what he said, though, and members of his own party were amongst those who were pushing back in the immediate aftermath. So Maryland Senator Ben Cardin said a new Republican state voting laws were very troublesome, but he said, I don't know if I'd use those terms. Which is the diplomatic way of saying, what on earth are you talking about? This was one of several low points in a press conference Biden held as he approached his one-year anniversary in the job. He also ploughed into his broader agenda, his low poll ratings, and of course, Ukraine. We'll come to those in just a minute. But first, John Cook is a postdoctoral research fellow at Monash University. He was the founder of the Skeptical Science website that seeks to give authoritative scientific responses to claims on climate change. And most recently, he co-authored a paper where machine learning was used to track the trends and the arguments used by climate contrarian sources. So we talked about that paper in an interview in depth, and I asked him about some of the tricky grey areas that you create in a democracy when you move from taking this old language of so-called science denialism and start applying it to so-called solutions denialism. It resulted in a fascinating dialogue, and it will be going live on this channel on Wednesday next week at 7 p.m. UK time. Join me for that. Joe Biden's press conference generated more headlines, almost none of them favourable to the administration. I mean, this is his one-year anniversary. You might think there'd still be a little honeymoon spirit still in the air, but no. In response to one question, he defended himself saying that no, he didn't overpromise on his agenda. And he said that the administration had made progress in fighting the pandemic. Well, one might suggest that there was a degree of overpromising in that he said that if he and not Trump had been president in 2020, then all of those people who died from COVID would not have died. I mean, he said that. I rather criticised it at the time. And of course, more people have died since he did become president, highlighting just what an extraordinary statement that had been. That wouldn't matter so much if he had been viewed as dealing effectively with the issue, even though he'd overpromised in the heat of the campaign. But in reality, his approach to the pandemic has been inconsistent, borderline authoritarian at times, and often illogical. And there's not a huge amount of evidence that much of it made a jot of difference to the outcome. You can always argue, well, if we hadn't done this, then it would have been worse. But then you have to point to places in the world where they didn't do that, and it was duly significantly worse. To all appearances, his ideological wing jumped on the pandemic, as they did on climate change, not as problems to be pragmatically addressed, but as an opportunity to transform the American social fabric. Well, a large part of the American people just want their lives to get back to normal and to deal with the immediate, very basic problems that they're facing. But mostly Biden says on his broader agenda, which he believes against the evidence is massively supported by the people, he has been obstructed by others. I did not anticipate that there would be such a stalwart effort to make sure the most important thing was that President Biden didn't get anything done. Adding, what are Republicans for? What are they for? This is pretty disingenuous from a party some of whose members floated not supporting vaccinations if President Trump was in charge when they came out. And you've got to remember as well, Biden stood as a moderate, a contrast to the radical base candidates in his party. There were primaries, there were lots of radicals, he was the moderate, and that's how he won. Fairly sure it wasn't on his youthful charisma. Pretty sure it was on the moderation, because it was held to be more electable. And he was duly elected. But since then, on a pretty thin margin, wafer thin in the Senate, you would assume that that was indeed, therefore, the call to govern as a moderate. Instead, there were huge spending bills, the sort of programmes much favoured by the party's radical wing. The choice to push for such large-scale measures is not wholly unconnected to the degree of opposition you then expect to provoke from the other side. The challenge for Democrats is that if you look at the polling, Biden is on a historic low approval rating, but his approval amongst voters identifying as Democrats still up at 82%. Approval is low because the majority of Americans live in the independent middle, and independents only give him 33% approval, with Republicans obviously right down on 5%. As the Democrats have moved to the left, they have left that majority of the country behind. That is their problem. But that's okay. When asked how he would win the centre ground back, he just said, that's all right, I don't believe the opinion polls. Not believing polls can be a canny thing to do under certain circumstances. It's well established that there's a shy conservative phenomenon where people are much less likely to tell pollsters the truth about their intent to vote Republican, particularly sharply defined when Trump is in the election. I'm not entirely sure what equivalent phenomenon Biden thinks is distorting the figures today, other than a large slice of wishful thinking. None of this was the most substantive part of the president's press conference impact, however. That came when he seemed to imply that he would accept Russia taking military action against Ukraine. During the era of Trump, we were used to the incidences where Trump would just say stuff and then his official team would scramble to clarify what he actually meant after the event. Well, that seems exactly where we remain today. So, this is what Biden said when he was asked about consequences for Russia if they invaded Ukraine. It depends on what he does as to what extent we're going to be able to get total unity on the NATO front. I think what you're going to see is that Russia will be held accountable if it invades. And it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and we end up having to fight about what to do and what not to do. This was immediately taken by some as signalling a green light to Putin, suggesting that a minor incursion might not be treated as that big a deal. Ukrainian officials were said to be shocked by Biden's comments for exactly that reason, as you might expect. And you would also expect, of course, Republicans went on the offensive big time. Former US Ambassador Nikki Haley, for instance, said this, "Imagine being Vladimir Putin and contemplating invading Ukraine. Then you see this train wreck of a press conference broadcasting Biden's weak leadership. Biden is emboldening Putin. This is so embarrassing." White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki tried to undo the damage in a statement after the press conference. "President Biden has been clear with the Russian president. If any Russian military forces move across Ukrainian border, that's a renewed invasion, and it will be met with swift, severe and united response from the United States and our allies." If he'd been that clear with Putin, you'd think he would have been likewise clear in his press conference, but there you go. In Wednesday's Q&A, I suggested that one of the only things that might retrieve Biden's presidency would be an external crisis that he surprised people by being unexpectedly competent in how he responded to it. Now, I did say it was a low probability outcome. On this showing, that last comment seems to be holding up pretty well. It has now been several weeks since the standoff between Russia and Ukraine began. We are no closer on the will they, won't they guessing game. Part of the challenge is that whereas during the time of the Cold War, no financial ties were developed between the West and the Soviet Union, in the modern era, both with Russia and with China, financial dependencies are making a number of countries much more conflicted about taking a stand. So we saw that this week, Europe and the US dropped the threat to expel Russia from the SWIFT international payment system if it invaded Ukraine. The system handles more than £100 trillion worth per week between banks in 200 countries worldwide. Removing Russia from that would have essentially cut Russian banks off from the West overnight. But in so doing, it would probably have done serious damage to the economy of, for instance, Germany, as well as several other EU states that have become pretty well embedded with Russia in terms of trade. Germany has focused instead on threats to the opening of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline and other targeted economic sanctions, which are easier because Nord Stream 2 isn't open yet. The UK this week shipped thousands of anti-tank weapons to Ukraine, part of an effort presumably to persuade Putin at the 12th hour that the cost of taking action would be as high on the battlefield as it would be in diplomatic terms. But Biden, frankly, had already admitted that NATO was divided on how to respond, and Putin has shown himself skilled in finding those courses of action most likely to discomfit opponents and to play on divisions. More talks were going on today, the outcome of which were uncertain, as always. It's hard to see where the breakthroughs are going to come from in this situation. As some of you know, I used to work on corporate responsibility. That meant rubbing shoulders from time to time with some of the top bosses of the biggest corporations in the UK, which is kind of a fascinating thing to see from a distance. Some of the good ones repeated the same principle often enough for it to stick with me. And it was that they would hire new people on their character, not just on their skills. Because you can teach skills easily, but people's character will out. And it was one reason why Southwest Airlines in the US, who in their prime were famed for how they treated their staff, they would monitor how the hotshot pilots they just interviewed for a job, how they treated the receptionist on the way in. How you dealt with others, especially those in jobs that you might dismiss as low status, was the unspoken key criteria for the job. If they were rude, if they were disrespectful to those people, and it didn't matter what hot shots they were, didn't matter what skills they had, they weren't going to work there. I mention this because we currently have this crisis over the UK Prime Minister, and yes, it comes down to a question of character. If you were ever seduced into thinking that Prime Ministers, they're the sort of people who have wield huge power, they can do whatever they want, the current situation should show you otherwise. Democracies are delicate. They run primarily on trust. Abuse that trust, disrespect the people who give it, however low status you may think they have, then you'll find your power ebbing away even before you've lost your formal position. The people angry about the number 10 parties were the people who kept the rules, even at great personal pain, not the ones who casually broke them. And it's the loss of their support that will bring this Prime Minister down, because they remain a sizeable enough minority, probably even a majority, people who will aim to do the right thing as they understand it, that you need them to elect you. Now, do people sometimes get away with things they shouldn't? Well, of course they do. But the principal lesson is to highly rate this, to work first and foremost on being the sort of person who deserves trust, the sort of person whose character will stand up to scrutiny. If you think that a country runs better with a system that has integrity, surely we do, The first step is to value people with integrity. And of course, also to aspire to be one of those people. I mean, think about the last time your integrity was tested. Maybe it failed. Why and what would you need to do to stand up stronger next time? Remember, every failure is an opportunity to improve, so long as you remember to learn from them. All right. And of course, it might be that you'll next get to test that integrity next Wednesday. You'll have noticed that I promoed a video with an interview with John Cook earlier on. As always, for interviews with third-party guests on topics likely to excite some interest, express your views on the issues under discussion as freely as you would want. Personal insults and attacks against guests will be removed. I love the fact that this channel is not an echo chamber, but I will not attract guests willing to talk about the most interesting issues if their experience is personally unpleasant. And that's only the practical point, but it should be a basic human value as well. I mean, I've had a number of moments in my life where I've been greeted with courtesy and respect when I turned up somewhere to speak to an audience about something where they thoroughly disagreed with me on, and they knew it before I even stood up to speak. Just because it's YouTube, not a live event, doesn't mean such courtesy can't exist here too. As I say, that doesn't affect the discussion of the ideas and the issues, which is always free and unfettered. I had one person attacking me on Twitter this week. One of the attacks was that the commenters on the insect apocalypse video I did a while ago on this channel, the commenters were drawing lessons from a video that he didn't agree with, and therefore he blamed me for feeding such reactions. I say to that person, too bad. Lie down in a quiet room until it goes away. The idea of a channel like this should have viewers drawn exclusively from the same tribe, all nodding in agreement. Well, no wonder you find it so easy to demonise people who think differently to you. Indeed, I even count some of the people who disagree with me on various points amongst the Patreon supporters of this channel, demonstrating exactly the sort of people who don't require ideological conformance to see value in what people are trying to do. To those people, and to all the good people who support this channel on Patreon, I owe a huge debt of thanks. They make these videos possible in the first place, since it would be impossible to put the time into making them otherwise. I look forward to the time when I can devote, well, all of my time to making videos, which is not quite possible yet. Maybe before the end of 2022. Who knows? If you would like to help make that happen, and add your support for the independent, fact-focused and non-ideological content that I aim to produce here, please head on over to patreon.com/Malin Baker. It is always appreciated. Either way, have a great week. My name is Malin Baker. This is the Malin Baker Show. Thanks for watching this video. If you liked it, please share with anyone else you think would also enjoy it. Word of mouth is really important to us. And if you've not subscribed yet, what are you waiting for? As the saying goes, that subscribe button won't smash itself.